This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. One persistent theme in the Democratic National Convention Wednesday was to portray President Donald Trump as unsuited for the White House, both in skills and temperament. Former President Barack Obama said Donald Trump has not grown into the job because he can't. Later, Joe Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, encouraged people to send a text to Biden's campaign and promised voting support that included planning and deadline notifications. Harris will make history when she accepts the Democratic nomination for vice president as the first black woman and Asian American on a major U.S. presidential ticket. President Trump's campaign team quickly responded to Democrats' criticism of Trump's temperament. In one case, the campaign said Democrats repeated the claim tonight that the president called immigrants or asylum seekers animals, but PolitiFact rated this flat-out false, and Snopes called it inaccurate. The campaign said that many Democrats who spoke Wednesday, like U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Biden's current running mate, U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, dismissed Biden as a viable candidate when they were running against him for the nomination. The campaign called the current support by some of those same people phony. Republicans will hold a virtual convention of their own next week to nominate President Trump to run for a second term. Senior advisor to President Trump, Jared Kushner, is calling on Iran to make peace with Washington, as Mr. Trump predicts there will be a quick return to U.S.-Iran negotiations if he is reelected in November. In an interview for VOA, Kushner, the president's son-in-law, appealed to Iranian President Hassan Rouhani to engage with Washington, saying it's time for the region to stop being stuck in conflicts of the past. It's time for people to get together and to make peace. This is VOA News. More than 784,000 people have died internationally from COVID-19. It's about 173,000 in the United States. There are more than 22 million confirmed infections globally, with the U.S. making up more than 5.5 million, Brazil more than 3.4 million, and India more than 2.7 million. No other country has reached 1 million confirmed cases, although Russia comes close. Brazil's health ministry says the spread of the coronavirus there could be about to slow, and reports the transmission rate has fallen below the key level, and that there are early signs of a gradual decline in the weekly totals of cases and fatalities. The cautious optimism comes despite figures again showing a steady rise in the number of confirmed cases and death toll within a 24-hour period. U.S. President Trump is blasting universities that have canceled in-person classes amid coronavirus outbreaks, saying the move could ultimately cost lives rather than save them. Trump said Wednesday at White House briefings that the virus is akin to the seasonal flu for college students. He said students pose a greater safety threat at home with older family members than on campuses. Trump cited no evidence to support the other contention, and White House did not respond to requests for information about on what Mr. Trump based his remarks. Health experts say the novel coronavirus appears to be deadlier than the seasonal flu and more easily transmitted. The European Union announces financial sanctions against Belarusian officials blamed for elections fraud and abuse of protesters. This as hundreds gathered in Minsk Wednesday night, defying an order from President Alexander Lukashenko. The head of the European Commission said it would reroute 53 million euros earmarked for Belarus away from the government. The EU, which held an emergency summit on the crisis, rejected Lukashenko's re-election in a disputed vote August 9th. The U.S. is giving an additional $204 million in humanitarian assistance to Iraqi citizens, Iraqi refugees, and hosting communities, according to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This is as Iraq's prime minister prepares to meet with President Trump Thursday at the White House to finish a two-month strategic dialogue to reshape relations between the two countries. Flint, Michigan is once again in the news in America after multiple outlets report that the state has reached a $600 million agreement to compensate Flint residents whose health was damaged by lead-tainted drinking water. The report says details will be released later in the week. Thousands of people have sued the state for its role in the crisis. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August the 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are meeting today to discuss the crisis in Mali. Meanwhile, there are concerns that the closure of borders with Mali may hurt regional trade and stability. Jailed Cameroon separatist leaders will appear in court today, Thursday. The United Nations says humanitarian workers face increasing violence, and it's official that Dr. Kizza Besigye of Uganda will not contest the 2021 elections.
They will deliberate on the recent socio-political developments in the Republic of Mali, and it will enable the head of state and government to exchange views on the best way to deal collectively with the situation.
Zimbabwe responds to Catholic bishops' criticism, and Kenyan farmers face food insecurity as the harvest season approaches. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. And government of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting today, Thursday, in an extraordinary session on the socio-political crisis in Mali. Thursday's meeting comes on the heel of this week's dramatic development when the military on Tuesday arrested President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and members of his government and forced him to resign. The junta has promised to hold elections within a reasonable time. When protesters first demanded President Keita's resignation, ECOWAS insisted that the only constitutional means of taking power is through the ballot box. So, the ECOWAS missed an opportunity to resolve the Malian crisis. And what is the purpose of today's meeting? Dr. Adiremi Ajibewa is ECOWAS's political affairs director.
They will deliberate on the recent socio-political developments in the Republic of Mali, and it will enable the head of state and government to exchange views on the best way to deal collectively with the situation in line with the ECOWAS protocol relating to the mechanism for conflict prevention, management, resolution, peacekeeping and security of December 1999, and also the supplementary protocol on democracy and good governance of 2001.
The position of ECOWAS during the mediation process by former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan was that the sub-region does not accept the taking of power through any other means except through the ballot box. There's been a military takeover. What do you think will be the reaction of the heads of state to that?
As you might have known, I think the head of state who affirmed the communique issued by the president of ECOWAS Commission, that of the AU, as well as the one that has just been recently released this evening by the United Nations Security Council. And then they will condemn the overthrow of President Ibrahim Keita, which seems to all of us that is a democratically elected government. And then they will also demand the release of President Keita, the Prime Minister Bobo Cisse, and possibly other government functionaries currently under detention, and categorically suspending Mali from all ECOWAS decision-making bodies with immediate effect as per the supplementary protocol that what is only accepted is constitutional order.
But the junta leaders have promised to at least have elections as soon as possible. Would that be acceptable?
That's not for me to decide, because the head of state are the last decision-making body of the Mediation and Security Council. They will look at the various extant principles, and then they will look at the situation on ground. And then it's on that basis of that they will decide.
Some people say ECOWAS missed an opportunity to resolve the crisis in Mali by its insisting that it would not accept the removal of the president through non-democratic means.
I don't believe that, because it means, in essence, that they are saying the mediation process seems to be a failure. No, you could see that even His Excellency, the former president of Nigeria, was there up to three times. I could say he was patient, he was not partial. However, the M5 RFP did not participate. So we cannot say it's a failure. A mediation process is a continuity.
It seems to me the fires in Mali may not be the only fires that the sub-region may be putting out soon. There is a situation in Cote d'Ivoire, and there is also a situation in Guinea. I'm sure these two countries may be on the minds of the heads of state.
Actually, as I've said, when you look at the extant protocol or instrument, that is usually what determines how issues will be looked into. The situations are not different, they are not similar, and they are not different.
Dr. Aderemi Ajebewa is Director of Political Affairs for the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Members of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, shut down all their land and air borders with Mali on Wednesday after its president announced his resignation following a military mutiny. ECOWAS said in a statement that it will also halt trade relations with Mali. Timothy Obiezu spoke with analysts about the expected political and economic fallout from the Mali coup.
The announcement was made in a statement released by ECOWAS from its headquarters in Nigeria after rebel soldiers seized and detained Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, and his prime minister. The regional body is also threatening stricter measures on trade with Mali, but macroeconomic analyst Ken Ife says this will have negative repercussions on Mali's economy.
Now, closing the border is the impossible thing you want to see happen, because you close the border, Mali is already an isolated country, landlocked country, and it depends on all its imports. It doesn't have a seaport, so when you close the border, you are actually shutting down the entire economy of Mali. And that is not a situation anybody desires.
Escalating political turmoil had gripped Mali since June, with Keita facing mass protests in Bamako demanding his resignation. Opponents pointed to the failing economy, government corruption, and a brutal jihadist conflict that has devastated Mali and its neighbors for several years. Hours after he was released from military custody, Keita officially resigned from office and dissolved his parliament and said he does not want any bloodshed. Jibrin Ibrahim, a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development in Nigeria, says he's against the ECOWAS decision to close borders.
But I think I'm even more worried about the failure of ECOWAS as a regional body to intervene effectively in the matter. They took a decision that they will not support the demands of the Malian people expressed through massive demonstrations for the President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to step down.
Ibrahim says the crisis will affect peace and stability in the Sahel.
The current political crisis may exacerbate the security situation in the region. That's the challenge, that's the worry, and that's what we'll seek solutions to.
In 2012, confusion in Mali following a coup d'etat resulted in al-Qaeda-linked militant groups taking hold of the northern half of the country. Mali was largely calm on Wednesday after Keita's resignation. While ECOWAS is calling for more sanctions on the forces behind the Malian coup, military officers are forging ahead with plans to create a transitional government. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
10 jailed Cameroon separatist leaders will appear in court today, Thursday, for an appeals hearing on their life sentence. Separatist leader Sisiko Ayuktabe and 9 others were sentenced to life after they were convicted of terrorism and rebellion against Cameroon. The separatists are fighting for independence of Cameroon's 2 English-speaking regions. They were arrested in 2018 and deported to Cameroon. Amogwa Tanyi is spokesperson for the jailed Cameroon separatist leaders' legal team.
It's been confirmed that they're going to appear in court Thursday, appearing at the appeal court of the Central Region in Yaoundé.
Have you had a chance to meet with Mr. Sisiko Tabe, and how does he think they are being treated?
It's been over 6 months that we've not accessed our clients. It's been incurably bad that we don't have access to them. We had to even stage a strike in front of the principal prison, Kondigi, where they are caged. They've taken pretexts that we cannot explain. they violate the laws of the country and international law. We've not been able to meet them, even to prepare our cases. During the last appearance a month ago, the French-speaking judge decided to talk to them very rudely, and he dismissed the appearance with a wave of the hand, and they returned to jail without understanding what actually transpired in court. They did not allow the lawyers to even raise anything, because in that court, we expected to get a translator and interpreter, since our clients, Mr. Tabe and the rest, are from the English-speaking part of the country. They do expect an interpreter and a translator, as provided for by the Criminal Procedure Code of the Republic of Cameroon.
A lot has been going on in Cameroon during their time of imprisonment. First of all, there is this tremendous violence that's been going on. And also, some people have suggested that while they are in jail, they have been negotiating their possible release, getting some people to wonder whether they are selling out the movement. Are they negotiating for their own release, and on what grounds?
I'm a lawyer, and I wouldn't actually talk lengthily on that. But I know on two occasions, our clients were taken out surreptitiously without our knowledge. We only heard about them being extracted or being produced out of the prison to some destinations in Yaoundé, where they talked about something that was going to take place between the government representative and Sisiku Ayuk Tabe and his team. It was kind of laying a foundation for possible negotiation, which Ayuk Tabe has always been preaching about. And he gave them conditions that for anything to happen, they must release every Southern Cameroon that is in detention. And if they are going to be talks, the talks are not going to take place in Cameroon.
Amungwa Tanyi is the spokesperson for the legal team of the 10 jailed Cameroon separatist leaders. He was speaking with us from Buya, capital of the Southwest region. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 20th. The United Nations says humanitarian workers are facing unprecedented levels of violence while risking their lives to provide life-saving aid to millions of civilians caught in situations of crisis. This year's World Humanitarian Day pays tribute to the thousands of unsung real-life heroes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This is an astonishing increase since January 2019, when the number of internally displaced people in Burkina Faso stood at 87,000. The UN Refugee Agency calculates 1 in 20 people, or 5% of the country's entire population, is now displaced, making this West African country the world's fastest growing humanitarian and protection crisis. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloch says most of the displaced have fled the northern and eastern regions of the country. Surging attacks by jihadists and various militia groups, he says, have forced many people to flee multiple times.
Host populations are at a breaking point as they share the little resources they have, while also facing themselves poverty, strained health services, and rapidly disappearing livelihoods for people who have fled wars, persecutions, and for communities hosting them. The additional impact of COVID is devastating.
The World Health Organization reports 1,240 cases of coronavirus, including 54 deaths. Ballard says the spread of COVID throughout the country is of concern, but he tells VOA that luckily there's not been any large-scale outbreak of the disease in the displaced communities. He says UNHCR staff has been working closely with the local communities to promote and maintain health and sanitation facilities wherever possible to keep the pandemic at bay. However, he adds the huge number of displaced in Burkina Faso and in the Sahel is worrying.
And also the remoteness of the locations, and also the cycles of violence that has produced and displaced people many times, it really makes it a challenge for us to keep up.
Ballard says people are in desperate need of shelter, food, water, protection, and health care. He says education is another priority, noting more than 2,500 schools affecting nearly 350,000 students have been forced to close after being targeted by armed men. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Four-time presidential candidate and founder of Uganda's largest opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, retired Colonel Dr. Kizza Besigye, has announced that he will not participate in the 2021 presidential elections. However, Dr. Besigye says he will continue to fight for the rights of Ugandans and lead them to what he calls liberation. Mugumi Davis Rakariji reports from Kampala.
While addressing party supporters this Wednesday, Dr. Besigye thanked his supporters for standing with him through the difficult times. He also thanked those who have left the party, including General Mugisha Muntu, a founding member of FDC, but now the head of another party, the Alliance for National Transformation. Dr. Besigye said their works have not been in vain.
I would like to thank the membership of FDC who constructed a struggle for the liberation of this country. Forum for Democratic Change are not just words. It's a forum for struggle to transfer power from those who captured it by force to the people of Uganda, so that we can talk of people rule and not gun rule as we have today.
Besigye was part of the then National Resistance Army, led then by President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, that captured power in 1986 through guerrilla warfare. He later fell out with his former war colleague Museveni and tried for four unsuccessful elections to unseat President Museveni. But Besigye said he has always won those elections, only to be denied of victory.
We went to court, same as 2001, everybody confirmed. That time there were seven judges. All seven judges confirmed this election is not free and fair. This is a record that will never be wiped away. A record on the election of Uganda. It's there. Anybody can go and read it.
After the 2011 elections, Besigye claimed President Museveni could not be defeated by the power of the ballot, only to come and contest again in 2016, in which he once again declared himself a winner and was seen being sworn into office as president. Besigye says the struggle to victory is not over yet.
The fight is on. So you have two channels that you must listen to. Channel A and Channel B. So some will be operating from Channel A, others will be operating from Channel B. But Channel B, mark you, supports Channel A fully. Every Ugandan should be a fighter for their right and freedom. And once they are fighters, we can win, whether election, whether no election.
With Kizza Besigye out of the 2021 presidential race, it is expected political new entrant Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, will be the main opposition challenger to incumbent Museveni in the 2020-2021 elections. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Zimbabwe's government has reportedly asked for a meeting with the Vatican representative in Harare to seek clarification whether the Catholic bishop's statement issued a week ago was done on behalf of the Vatican. The bishop said in their pastoral letter that Zimbabwe was suffering from a multi-layer of crisis, including economic collapse, deepening poverty, corruption, and human rights abuses. Speaking Wednesday at the ruling ZANU-PF party Politburo meeting, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said it was unfortunate for men of the club to use the pulpit to advance what he called a nefarious agenda for detractors of the country. Ebel Chikomo is a member of the Catholic Lawyers Guild.
I am not at all surprised by, you know, the responses from government. Both the message from the president and the message from the Minister of Justice is very much in keeping with the attitude of our government, you know, where anybody who actually expresses, say, an alternative view, anybody who actually says anything contrary to what the government wants to hear is labeled an enemy. And anyone who actually also tries to speak for the people, for the suffering majority, is seen as trying to actually push the agenda of the West. It's as if Zimbabweans don't think for themselves. It's as if, you know, the church is meant to be an organ of the ruling party. It's not the case.
The president said that, you know, the church and Zimbabwe, dating back to its liberation struggle, have had some good relationship. Now, he says, unfortunate when men of the cloth begin to use the pulpit to advance a nefarious agenda for detractors of our country. He's saying that the church is on the side of the opposition.
That's exactly the point I'm making. We have heard, for example, the president talk about the role the church played, you know, during the Liberation War period, which is very important, very good work, you know, the church did. But the president did not talk about the role the church played, you know, during Gukurahundi in the early 80s. The church continued on a very principled stance, speaking truth to power, challenging the wrongs, you know, and being the conscience and voice of society. But now they're now talking about the church as if it were just pushing the agenda of our former colonial, you know, master. The church is not an organ of any political party. They are not an appendage of the ruling party. They are not an appendage of the opposition. The church is the conscience of society.
It seems that President Mnangagwa is not the only one who has come out to respond to the church's criticism. The Zimbabwe Herald, in its editorial, was very critical of the church's comment, describing the church as the torchbearer of imperialism and neocolonialism, and suggesting that the church, by trying to assume a higher moral ground, the church is yet again trying to use soft power to cause a change of government in Zimbabwe.
It is indeed a very serious claim, James, but it's a claim to be expected coming out of the Herald. You know, it is also a claim to be expected coming out of government, because that is exactly their default position. Whenever the wrongdoings have been pointed out, whenever, you know, someone speaks out against the wrong that government is doing, that's their default position. James, do you really believe that Zimbabweans don't see, you know, the difference between right and wrong? Do you believe that Zimbabweans can't see, can't tell when their rights are being violated? Do they require foreign powers for them to know that they are suffering, to know that they are dying in hospitals because there are no drugs, because the government's priorities are misplaced? Do they need someone to actually tell them that this is corruption when they see it in their faces? So I am not surprised.
Abel Chikomo is a member of the Catholic Lawyers Guild. He was speaking with us from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare. More than a million Kenyans are currently in a crisis of food insecurity brought about by a flood and the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Kenya Food Insecurity in collaboration with World Food Program Outlook Report. Farmers are panicking as the harvest season approaches because of the damage to their crops caused by desert locust, flooding, and COVID-19 measures. Marie Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
According to the Kenya Food Security Steering Group, COVID-19 restrictions have negatively impacted household incomes, increases in food and non-food commodity prices here in Kenya. The maize, millet, green grams and vegetable are ready to harvest, but in small portion and nowhere to sell due to restrictions by the government in combating COVID-19 pandemic. Maina Thuku is a farmer from central Kenya. He said that millions of locusts are already wreaking havoc in their farms and that a four-month harvest is all gone to waste.
On this side, I harvest 21 bags of maize. On the other side, I harvest 18 bags of sorghum and millet. I also harvest 8 to 12 bags of green grams, depending on the rain. All my harvest has been eaten by the locusts. We are here wondering what we'll do.
The Kenyan government has warned farmers of a shortage of crucial farming accessories such as fertilizer due to COVID-19 movement restrictions. Experts have also indicated that locusts are heading towards Western Kenya. The farmers are warning that this is a recipe for food insecurity and hunger. Paul Kisiangani is a farmer from western part of Kenya and is blaming the government for not putting up measures to avert food insecurity in the country.
At the moment, we are not seeing any preparedness measures being put in place by the government. Kakamega, we are a worried lot. I can tell you, we are preparing our fields for maize production. If these locusts land, then we'll have no food. That will be a food security disaster. I'm a dairy farmer. I have my Napier here. If the locusts land, then they will clear the Napier. We will see sugar factories closing down, and these will really affect our livelihoods.
Experts warn that the East African food supply chain has never been the same since COVID-19 struck, and that with the migration of locusts, the situation is expected to worsen. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Thursday, August 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.